I ended up going backstage, lying down in the green room because I was so out of it. Walked down onto the stage, and they have a big curtain there. Normally, I would peek out and see what the hell's going on, but I didn't even fucking care. And I remember the show started, and I had my back to the crowd, and I was facing the drums, and I kind of spit water up into the air and doing my thing as we're getting into the song called King. And I turn around, and the place is fucking packed. And I just, it took my breath away. Like, I just remember going, holy, I don't know what I was expecting, but not that. And I just remember thinking, holy fuck. We did a 60-minute show, and I went from feeling like 1 out of 10 as far as energy level to like injection of fucking adrenaline going, let's get it, man. And just leaving everything on the stage.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs and a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Todd McTavish. He's a songwriter, and it's all he's ever wanted to do. At 23, he left his small-town home in Ontario and moved to L.A., and at 53, he just signed his first record deal. Todd's an old-school rock and roll troubadour. The stories come fast and hard. He recorded a Christmas song with Billy Bob Thornton, had one of his songs played at the Super Bowl, and he owned a half-bear, half-wolf named Jazz, who was an excellent judge of character. But this isn't about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's about having the courage to say yes. Now, as someone that tends to overthink things until I talk myself out of them, Todd's journey inspired me. The music industry is a parable for life. It's cruel and unfair, and it gave Todd 1,000 really good reasons to quit. So how has he survived when so few others haven't? When an opportunity came up, no matter how crazy, he said yes. Please enjoy Todd McTavish. All right, Todd McTavish. I'm super excited for this conversation. I've had it circled on my calendar since we arranged it, I don't know, a month and a half or so ago. I've got a ton of questions, and I really look forward to digging into this.
Likewise. Good to be here, guys. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So it's interesting. I don't talk to a lot of songwriters, but I'm a massive fan of music and good songs. It's just been sort of a part of my identity. It always has been. But my relationship with music has sort of changed throughout my life. And so I've become really fascinated with talking to artists lately about their creative process. And as I start creating more content for my audiences. So it's interesting. If you asked me what I'd be most excited about a conversation like this, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, it would basically be like, I want the MTV behind the music with Todd McTavish. I want to hear the sex, drugs, rock and roll, the crazy stories. And I still have probably an unhealthy fascination with stuff like that. But what I'm really most interested in is just the journey of a dude that moves to LA with nothing but a dream and a guitar case in his early 20s and signs his first record deal in his 50s, man. Like, that is a book I want to read. That is a movie I want to see. That is awesome. What a story. That's crazy. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, no, I think there's a little bit crazy involved in doing all that when I look back in retrospect. I mean, it's not normal, that's for sure. I didn't stay on the beaten path, but I just went for it. I mean, there was an itching. I found songwriting as like a gift. It's something that it just made sense to me one day. I woke up and went, I can do that. I've been doing that. I've been sitting in school scribbling lyrics, and I didn't know what I was doing. And then one day it was suggested to put it to music, and it just was like a light bulb going off where I was like, wow, yeah, this is what I do. It was easy. And I think anywhere in life when you find that calling, so to speak, it just makes sense to you. It's easy. So I started writing, and I just never stopped. I write more today than I did when I was consumed with Judge Jackson, the band I was with for 20 years. I always looked at it like, if I'm going to write this stuff, I need to get out there and feel this stuff and experience this stuff. I can't just stay safe. I think that was my whole attitude. And that had a lot to do with me moving south. I looked at LA as like the mecca of like songwriters. And I liked the fact that there was palm trees and there wasn't a winter like I was used to. And little elements like that had a lot to do with LA being a destination point. And then waking up to an opportunity to move to LA, I'd been playing with a guy in Toronto. He was a drummer. I got a call one morning from this guy, literally out of the blue. He's like, want to move to LA with me? And it was like, are you kidding me? Like, yeah, why not? And it was as simple as that. He goes, I'm moving in like 6 months. I'll start saving some money and we'll move on down there. So there was no plan. It was just kind of, he had a plan. He was going to school. I was like just tagging along. I was working at Hostess Frito-Lay in Toronto as a truck driver. And I just started saving money because I knew I couldn't work down here out of the gate at least. So I need to have some funds. I remember, like, I think it was in January 94, the earthquake in Northridge. The paper that morning was LA Rocks. And I remember cutting the headline out and wrapping that around this little jar that I had, this little plastic jar, taping this lid on it with a Rambo knife, cutting a hole in the middle, just like a piggy bank. And so every week when I got paid, any money I could spare, I jammed into this jar. That was my LA Rocks savings account. So by the time I left, I ripped it open and had a few $1,000s saved up. And I said this, I mean, a few $1,000s went a lot further then than it did now, I'll tell you that. But we drove off. I was stopped at the border and my buddy, you know, was questioning, I'm going to school here, my credentials. And I remember him asking me, and I'm like, I'm just tagging along, soul searching, songwriter, just going out there and finding myself. And I remember that border man looking at me going, uh-huh. Like, I was almost denied. I've got some border stories, but this was one of them. And I remember him basically coming this close to denying me right then and there, going, well, when are you coming back? And I'd heard 6 months, 6 months, like, make sure you get back in 6 months. So I remember going, oh, within 6 months, I'll come back. No, well, you make sure you come back to Canada. All right. And off we went. So when I got to LA, I just remember thinking, what now? And that first day, we ended up getting an apartment right in Hollywood, La Brea and Franklin, which is like right there. When you watch the Academy Awards, I lived behind that place. In our apartment, we had nothing. I slept on the floor, like in a poncho. I didn't even bring a sleeping bag. Like, I don't know really what I was thinking, but I don't think I was thinking. And I think the second day we went down to the clubs, the Whiskey A Go-Go, the Rainbow Bar and Grill, these famous clubs that I heard of. And I was just like a child. I just remember thinking, holy fuck, I'm in this major city. I know nobody. But I was electrified at the same time. And by day three or day four, I started picking up the fanzine magazines. I advertised myself as Todd the Hitman McTavish. I write lyrics. If you need a song to be written, call me. So I started getting callbacks from people. Started just getting myself out there, auditioning for bands. I really just wanted to write songs for other artists. That was my whole thing. I just want to write songs. Don't care if I'm on stage. Don't care if I'm in front of the camera. I just like writing songs. That was my whole thing from the beginning. And my project, I remember, was called Chief. So I had all these songs that I demoed. So I would play them for people and started getting gigs, writing lyrics for other people. And I would demo them with them and started meeting people that way. And then I started auditioning for a few bands because I was like, why not, just to meet people, right? It was enough to like get my feet wet, enough to start doing gigs. I was writing songs. I was gigging. I was singing, doing stuff all of a sudden. And that was enough to make me go, yeah, this could work out down here. And so 6 months later, I ended up flying up to Vancouver because I had to renew my health insurance because my parents were very adamant of like, make sure you're covered down there because you're not covered health-wise. So I ended up in Vancouver. And then on the way back at the airport, a nightmare ensued. I get there and the guy's like, well, where's your return ticket to Canada? I'm like, well, I came up here, then I'm going back. And he was like, well, what are you doing down there? Well, I was soul searching, writing songs, finding myself, man. I got long hair and tie-dye shirt at the time, you know. And I remember him looking at me going, I'm denying you access into the United States of America. Your trip ends here in Vancouver. And I just remember thinking, can you do this? And it turns out they can. So I ended up going back to my buddy's place, kind of in shock because this wasn't part of the plan. I'm like, I got to go back and record a record, dude. Like, I mean, I don't got time for this. So the next day I got on a bus. Well, I'll go to Seattle, then I'll fly to LA from there. We'll try a different angle here. We get on the bus. They march us into this turnstile, like the border there. And they pull my name up and they go, you know, bells and whistles went off. Oh, it looks like you were denied entrance yesterday at the airport. Can you talk about that? I'm like, well, I don't know why. I think he was just in a weird mood. But so he goes, so you've got your ticket. You're going to refund it. You're going to fly from Seattle to LA. And I'm like, yeah. He goes, yeah, I don't know what happened, but I'm denying you access again. So I had been denied twice right back to back, right? And so then I ended up flying back to Canada, where I stayed for like 6 weeks at my sister's place in Kitchener, hanging out with Chad Henry. Just I didn't know what I was doing. Was I was coming or going, you know. My sister probably just got sick of me, crashed on her couch for like the last 6 weeks. She gets me in the car. She goes, "We're going to go shopping. I'm going to get you some stuff or whatever." I passed out. I woke up looking at the border guy in Buffalo. And she driven me to the border. And I started kind of panicking. And I just remember not saying a word. And we're just going shopping at the Galleria. And the next thing I know, we were in Buffalo. So she drove me to the train station, where I ended up getting a train ticket and taking a train back to L.A., where I was picked up by the band, by the rhythm section, who then told me that the band had dissolved. And we want you to be in our band. I just remember thinking, I don't really want to be in your all's band. I was conflicted. I got back and basically was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Ended up hanging out with some friends in Hollywood and ran into an old friend that I'd met in that first 6 months. And she was like the bartender at the Whiskey A Go-Go. She's like, "I need to get a place." I'm like, "I need to get a place." So we got a place together. So I woke up one day, not long after we'd become roommates, no direction at all, thinking, what am I fucking doing? I've been down here like 7 or 8 months, right? Still my first year. And her boyfriend comes in. She goes, "Yeah, this is my boyfriend. And he's going to learn. He's just staying here for a minute." And he had another guy with him. And he's like, "Yeah, I'm going to go into the back room and talk to Maureen. You guys just hang out," or whatever. And I'm thinking, "We'll hang out. Like, this is my apartment. Like, who are you?" You know? So this guy walks in and we're kind of sizing each other up. And he goes, "Well, I'm Lee Jackson from Dallas, Texas. I play the guitar. I play the booze. I like guns. And I like to drink." And I looked at him and went, "Well, I'm Todd and I'm from Toronto and I like to sing the blues and write songs. I don't really like guns, but I don't mind drinking." And this was Lee Jackson, who I ended up becoming best friends, bandmates, business partners for the next 20 years. And this is how we met. So we exchanged numbers and I said, "You know, when you get back, call me and let's get together and write a song." Like, there was a little magic going on. So the next day I get a call and it's him. And he's like, "Yeah, I'm outside of your apartment right now," because the intercom was connected to the phone. I'm like, "Oh, shit, dude. I didn't think I was going to hear from you for like a month." He goes, "Yeah, I was thinking about you." So he goes, "Well, why don't we write a song today?" I said, "Well, that sounds like a good idea." So I went out front and there was this dude in a jacked up pickup truck and Lee. And I get in and I'm introduced to this guy and his name's Chris. So I get into the truck and we drive for another 10 minutes into North Hollywood off of Laurel Canyon. And we park and we walk into this place, which we ended up calling the junkyard, which was this little house, big lot. I remember these two humongous dogs rushing the gate at me. And I remember thinking, "Are we cool, dude?" He goes, "Well, if you're cool, these dogs are cool. But if you ain't cool, I don't know." And I remember in that moment going, "I'm cool." We walk into this garage that had been turned into a jam hall, big drum riser, drums, PA, the whole nine yards. We sit down finally. And I remember Chris cracking out a bong and he goes, "You smoke weed, Todd?" I'm like, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah." And Lee put his guitar down and he throws a bag of weed on the guitar and starts loading up the bong. Lee grabs a guitar, shows me, and he goes, I go, "Well, I'm thinking, well, let's write a fucking song. I don't know what's going on or where I am all of a sudden, but I'm here to write a song, you know." But this was part of the journey, right? Looking back, it was these little moments that were all like just part of writing songs to me. You got to live it to really like write about it. You know, that was my whole thing. And I'll be damned, we wrote a song right then and there. In 4 minutes, we wrote a song. It just came out of him. I just jumped in. "Missed my plane to LA. The bus left without me. I've got no food, no money. Where I end up, I guess we'll see." We wrote this song called Starting Over right then and there. And me and Lee were looking at each other going, like, it was magical. Like, it was one of those, when you hear about those magical moments, it was like, holy fuck, that was easy. And then he goes, "Well, that was fucking cool." He goes, "Man, I got another riff, dude." I'm like, "Let's hear it." And we wrote another tune called Trainwreck right there that ended up being on our first record ultimately. So within 10 minutes, we already wrote 2 songs, like just boom, boom. And I remember me and Lee looking at each other like, "Yeah, man, this is like a mess." It's like when you meet your soulmate kind of deal where you're just like, "Wow, dude, like this is great." And I remember Lee and Chris looking at each other. Chris was like, "Yeah, man, he's the guy. He's the guy." And so they were recruiting me to be the singer in their band. I was just there to write a song. I was kind of like, again, I didn't care to be in a band. And so all of a sudden they're like, "Do you want to be the singer of our band?" And I'm like, "What band?" He goes, "Well, we got a band. There's no name to it, but we need a singer." And I was like, "Fuck it. Yeah. So that band ended up becoming Judge Jackson. And Lee's like, well, I got to go to Hawaii. When I get back, we're going to start rehearsing. And so when he got back, me and him ended up moving into this place. So we moved into the house and we just started writing fucking tunes every day. Just, I'm here to fucking write songs. So all of a sudden now this was happening. Like, so within a year of me being finally in LA, now things are starting to like roll.
So you covered a lot there. And I mean, this is awesome, Todd. I want to add just a couple of questions. Do you ever think, you know, when you're talking about getting stopped at the border multiple times, if any of that happens differently, if the first border guard lets you right through, you never meet Lee, you go and record this shitty album with some bunch of band that never goes anywhere. Do you ever reflect on that? How magical that is that sometimes shit happens that way?
Oh, yeah. That is the magic of life, Bob. That's like so many things could have happened or not happened. And that's life, because there were many times where, I mean, I was so grateful for what we ended up doing together. We didn't make it to the top of that mountain that we were shooting for, but we made it onto that mountain. You know, I'll give it that. We certainly fucking tried and we died trying, you know, and I'm proud of the journey that I was a part of with Judge Jackson.
Yeah, when you're sitting there telling me that story, I'm thinking about, for one thing, I'm sort of thinking about as a parent now of kids that are your age. So I'd love to hear how, you know, whether the parents pushed back at all or how they felt about it.
As a parent now, I couldn't imagine my daughter going, hey, dude, I'm just going to fuck. No, you're not. Like, my parents were pretty, they knew me to the point where they were just like, good luck, right. You know, like... They always have a home to come home to, but I guess they knew me well enough where they're like, you're going to do whatever you're going to do. We think you're crazy and you're probably a little bit nuts for even attempting to do this, but good luck. You know, they were fully supportive. You're never going to go anywhere if you don't at least attempt to try and do it. And I look at that as life. Like sometimes you got to risk it to just get out of your comfort zone. It was certainly getting out of my comfort zone.
You mentioned, you dropped a name, Chad Henry. So that's how you and I cross paths. I've known Chad and yeah. Not as long as you have. But when I was telling him about having you on the podcast, he's like, oh, you got to have Todd tell you about this crazy fucking dog in this junkyard. He said it was the biggest, scariest. I think it was half wolf, half bear. So that was the
dog. I think it was. I mean, and that's a good description. And as comical as that sounds, Bob, that is no lie. This dog was the greatest. I was talking about this dog yesterday, as a matter of fact. His name was Jazz. He was that dog that rushed me at the gate. I'm like, holy shit. Like, look at the size of this thing. It was, you know, it was part wolf, part bear. I'm convinced. But it was the coolest dog. You know, when you look back, if you've had pets or whatnot, there's that one pet that you were like, that was just the greatest dog. This was that dog. He was so cool. Great judge of character. If there was a problem, only two times there was a problem, people were Jazz would all of a sudden he'd be like, and both times those people ended up have been very problematic. I ended up adopting the one dog and Lee adopted the other dog. They were brothers. There's two of them. And when we moved in, they were Chris's dogs, and he ended up, I brought a stripper that I had met to his birthday party about a month after we'd moved in for a gift, and he ended up going to Vegas and marrying that girl. So he left. Like, so all of a sudden, me and Lee kind of took over the junkyard, and it was our place. So we jammed there. We lived there. I mean, we'd play shows in LA all the time, and that's everybody would go back to our place. It was that kind of a place. Like, the cops were constantly coming by going, what the hell is going on in here?
Before I forget, the songwriting. So you talked about how natural it was with Lee, and I've heard some songwriters, I remember Neil Young talking about this. I've heard other people talk about it too. It's that they don't feel like they write songs as much as they create an environment and they're sort of a conduit. And the songs are out there. They're kind of floating around. Their job is to just be a channel for them to get them from there down to a page out to the world. And so does that resonate with you at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Songs are in the wind. Like, I think as a songwriter, you just know how to grab them and then put them in a format that you can hear them too. They're everywhere. They're infinitive. That's how I look at it. Like, so I think that's a good way to put it. Like, I can hear melodies with the birds, with the wind. And as a songwriter, your gift is just to channel that. So now I can put it into a context where you can hear it too. Good songs, they just write themselves effortlessly. Sometimes, like, and I look at it as a gift of God. Like, that's what I've always said, because sometimes I'll look at the page and go, where did this come from?
Yeah.
Like when I try and write songs and try and, okay, I'm going to write about this and rewrite it and this and that, at the end of the day, it sucks. I'm like, when I just turn off and just write what the Lord pushes through me, that's almost how I look at it. That's the good stuff. Don't think too much, like just write, you know, and that's the, and it's simple. Like good songs to me are real simple. Good songs, you can play with two hands on a piano. Great songs, you can play with one finger. You know, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. That melody is everything. A great song, you can just sing on its own. Like Happy Birthday, we all know how to sing that. You don't need an accompaniment. You don't need a guitar player. It just holds its own with the melody. Lee and I probably wrote 300 plus tunes together, just me and him. So you learn how to craft a song a little bit better the more you do it with any, you know, trade. You say, like, I feel like with songwriting, you get better with age.
Yeah.
You kind of start understanding how to write as you get older. And so it gets better, in my opinion. I think songwriters get better with age.
Well, do you still write with other people or do you do most of it alone now, or is it a mix?
I do it mostly alone now. I've got like three different projects going on right now, but I'll still write with other people and collaborate when it naturally happens. Mm. Like I was just at this bar the other day seeing a band that were kind of recruiting the guitar player for this one band I've got called Tunstall's Ranch, the Southern kind of Chris Stapleton kind of vibe thing going on. And we went out to see this guitar player, and he's a good friend of the drummer in this Tunstall's Ranch project of mine. So we got talking about writing songs, and he's like, we need to have a barbecue. You and I need to write some Tennessee Dirt, some swampy tunes. I'm like, absolutely. Like, so that's how collaborations start working, where you're like, yeah, man, let's get together. Let's do this.
So I love hearing about where that inspiration come from and not trying so hard and trying to create the circumstances for those ideas to flow and not trying to force it. But I do want to get back to Judge Jackson, when the band was just getting started, you and Lee had started to write and the band was taken off. I do remember Judge Jackson, a couple of those early songs. And so I'd love to just, you know, what was that process like? How did the band take off? You made a bunch of albums. Like what happened then?
Well, we ended up doing 10 records, 10 albums, and eight of our songs ended up getting licensed and put into TV shows or movies or played at sporting events. Or we had like the theme song for Victory Lane, the wrap-up show after all the NASCAR races for like 3 years. We were played at a lot of sporting events, NHL games, NFL games. You know, they would play in the stadium or on the telecast. The mecca of the sporting events to me was the Super Bowl. I got a call from our manager the night before the Super Bowl saying, hey, I think these guys are going to play one of your tunes during the telecast on the Super Bowl. And I just remember thinking, I'm going to watch this whole fucking game. Not that I wouldn't anyways, but I was like, to hear like, you know, one of our songs. I watched the whole pregame, the whole first quarter and towards the second quarter. I'm like, I remember going to the bathroom. And of course, when I'm in the bathroom for that moment, they start playing one of our tunes. And so my wife at the time's like, dude, they're playing it right now. Come back and I hear the tail end of it. I'm like, oh, just to hear your voice. I was surprised that they even played to the point where I was singing. I just figured they'd play a little tidbit of like the music, you know, and edit out the. But all of a sudden I come down to hearing my voice drowning out Troy Aikman as he's talking about, you know, and I'm like, fucking hey, dude, this is great. So I just remember being on cloud nine going, this is pretty cool. And then in the third quarter, they played another tune and they played like a minute and a half of it, which to me blew my mind. I figured maybe 10 seconds, 15 seconds. It just went on and on. And I was just like giddy going, oh my God. And then in the fourth quarter, they played a third tune, another tune. By that point, I was just like, this is the best sporting experience I've ever had in my life. I mean, they've just played three of our tunes almost in entirety throughout the telecast. Like, it just blew my mind.
How does the licensing work on that? Like, if you don't want me asking, yeah. Like, do you make a lot of money when that happens? Or
ironically, not for the Super Bowl. For the Super Bowl, not a lot of money. A couple coins, but ironically, they don't pay a lot. Like the performer that does the halftime show, they don't make any money doing that.
Yeah.
It's the biggest thing, but it's incredibly cheap to the artist in a weird way. But I had another song on this TV show called My Name is Earl, and it was on NBC. And it's our songs playing out of the Camaro when Earl and his dad are working on the song or working on the car. And I remember obviously watching it going, oh my God, I made a lot of money on that. Like something like that. I still see residuals for that. And so it just depends what it's licensed for. It's nothing's like equal. It's like that can be fucking a payday. That can be nothing. You should just be lucky to have your song on this, you know?
I think about that a lot because, you know, you go to Nashville or something, right? And you see these guys playing in bars for nothing, handing a hat around, guys on the street. They're better than half the shit I hear on the radio. And probably nobody's ever going to know their name. Like, that town is packed with insanely talented people. And I'm like, how do you muster the wherewithal to keep going when there are, I don't care how good you are, there are thousands of you.
That's that burning desire that one has. Yeah. And they're just like, this is what I fucking do, make it or break it. Like, right. It takes. And I think when guys do make it and you hear them going, I'm so blessed and I'm so grateful, they really are. They know, like, oh my God. You know, my sister was telling me about this story, about this experiment this university did. They took two artists and they're like, how does somebody make it that's so fucking talented? And yet somebody else doesn't make it that's just as talented. What? How is this possible? They took these two artists that were like the same age, same neck of the woods, very similar in their art. And one made it, fucking made it. And the other one did not. And they're like, what was the difference in the curvature? Where was this moment that one went off? And the only thing different that they could find in the study that they did was that the one guy went to a party one night in New York and met a guy named Andy Warhol that took a liking to him and his work. And the rest is history. Sometimes it's about meeting that right person at the right time. It can come out of nowhere. It can be just fucking fluke. They just happen to be there. That can happen. Like, you know, and you're the guy. And then at the same time, it cannot happen. And you can play your whole life and be really good and, you know, make maybe a mild living doing your thing. But it's not fair, Bob. You really have to want to be in this. There's got to be something deep inside you that wants to pursue it. And only you can do that. You know, you got to be a little mentally crazy, mentally strong. There's a lot of negativity that you'll deal with. You learn to have tough skin and to deal with the rejection. Like an actor, you deal so much rejection. It's amazing you don't just snap out. And a lot of people do. But you just learn, I think, with time. It is what it is, man. That's what you learn. Like, I'm going to do this whether you like it or not. And you just start taking that kind of mindset. I do this for me. You have to separate it. You have to pour your heart out. But at the same time, you almost don't have expectations anymore. You just look at it, go, keep fucking forward, forging forward, but don't have expectations. Things happen. Cool. Like, I just recently got a record deal. I signed it like in December with this band that asked me to do some vocals for them. So as a favor, I'm like, yeah, I'll sing on your record. I'll sing some tracks. And they already have a record, but they're like, well, we're doing this. We're doing that. Could you, because I was getting him to do drum tracks for me. So he's like, well, I'll do some drum tracks for you, for your stuff. If you could sing on my stuff. I'm like, sure. And all of a sudden they're like, you think we could have lunch with you? You know, I'm like, yeah. So we get together and they kind of sit down and it was like Judge Jackson all over again. Could you be our singer in the band? Like, I think you should just be our singer. I'm like, I got nothing better going on. Sure. Why not? Next thing I know, this guy's wrangled up a fucking record deal where I'm like still in disbelief over it, going, how did you do that? Like, they're based out of Montreal, Canada, actually. We've never even jammed in the same room together. They'll send me the tracks and I'll do them. I'll send them the tracks. I'll submit tunes to them. But here's a situation where I've done so very little and I'm signing a record deal. You know, nothing might come of it. Everything could come of it. You know, all we can do is like make the best record we can make and whatever's going to happen. That's the way I look at it. Like, but nevertheless, I look at Judge Jackson and what we did, the hundreds, if not thousands of shows. I stopped counting shows after our 1,000th show. I stopped counting songs after we wrote 100, you know, for every one song that made it on a record, we probably wrote 3 tunes. But yeah, you can do all the right things and not get anywhere. You can do nothing. And all of a sudden shit starts falling on your lap and you're like, what the fuck?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. Yeah, Todd, because you say it's not fair and it's not just the music industry that's not fair. But listening to you recount all of that, the one thing that you've done is just said yes. Like, there's so many things that were opportunities that were presented to you. And yeah, it's not fair. Maybe there's some shit luck involved, like the person meeting Andy Warhol at a party. But the one thing you can do is just stay curious. And they want to have lunch. Okay, let's go have lunch. They want me to write a song. Sure, I'll write a song. Like, a lot of us put all these obstacles, like, where's that going to go? That's a waste of time. I don't want to do that. And listening to you, it sounds like I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. Why not? Let's go do this. Let's err on the side of saying yes to things.
Don't ever get so jaded where you just shut down and say, fuck it. At the very least, a friendship could happen, or like you just never, that's what I've learned. Sometimes the worst things that we've done have turned out to be the best things.
Yeah.
Like I'll share a little story. I ended up having the pleasure of working with that actor, Billy Bob Thornton. Our manager got a hold of us and she said, I want you to write a Christmas tune so we can license it. So Lee and I wrote this tune called Christmas Tree. So she gives it to a producer friend of hers that works for Fox. And he calls her up and goes, I like the tune. So he calls her up and says, I just want Todd and Lee to come down to the studio because it's in someone's house. I want them to meet the guy and see if it's going to be applicable to record in this guy's house. So I roll down there. We get to this really nice house. We get inside. I'm escorted down into this really cool studio. And at this point, I'm like, this is pretty cool. Billy Bob Thornton walks in. It's his fucking house. It's his studio. Like, it's crazy. Slash used to own the house. Put this cool studio in the basement. Sold the house to Billy Bob. And then Billy started recording all. Like, he's like a phenomenal musician. Don't get surprised with the movie star bit. He's a musician. That's really what it is. The movies just fund his habit in the music world. So anyways, we record this fucking tune called Christmas Tree. And I ended up going to his house like 8 times doing sessions for one tune. Like sometimes we would just hang out. We kind of became buddies and it was just like cool to hang out and whatnot. But he told me this story when his band was up in Canada and they were in the middle of a tour and he did this radio interview and it just went off the fucking rails. I think 5-10 minutes into the interview, he walked out. He's like, fuck you. I told you not to mention the movie star bit and whatnot. And just the interviewer was really rude to him or whatever happened. But he goes, I was so pissed off and I had gotten food poisoning the night before. I just didn't give a fuck. We ended up canceling the rest of the fucking tour. Like it was just a shit show. It just went off the fucking rails. I'm like, that's shitty. He goes, but the moral of the story is that interview was so shitty. Canceled the last 5 dates we had on the tour. In my musical career, I had such a spike. We had more sales, more press from that. It turned out to be the greatest thing that ever fucking happened in my musical side of things. So the moral of the story is things can go according to plan and that's great. But sometimes when they don't, it can end up being even better.
Hilarious you mentioned that with Billy Bob. So I have a drumstick in my house from Billy Bob.
So do I.
Because Billy Bob might have canceled a bunch of dates on that tour, but he did play a couple more because a couple of days after that interview, he was opening for Willie Nelson in my hometown. And my wife and I were like in the 5th row.
Nice.
And afterwards, he threw a drumstick out because my wife's cute and she was in the 5th row and she caught it. And that was awesome. What a small world, right? And you're hanging out with Billy Bob and Willie.
Yeah, I got a drumstick with his name on it. He's whatever he signed it. I think he signed it to my kid. Yeah, he's a drummer. He ended up playing the drums on the tune that we played. I would go there the next day and he's like, and it's just me and Billy. And he's like, yeah, man, you know, like that song, you know, and I'm thinking, it's not going to work out. It's okay, buddy. Like, I mean, you know, we don't need to beat around the bush. Like, let's just move forward with your word. We're leaving these tracks the way they are. But just such a cool guy. Like, when you see cool in the dictionary, there's a picture of Billy Bob dressed as Bad Sand and they're looking back at you.
One thing I've always wanted to ask Todd, sort of ask people that create art like this. So it's interesting. When I think back, for example, on my kind of my adolescence, right? And this is usually a time for a lot of people where music means a lot to them, right? Because we're all trying to find our group and our people. And so we're trying to figure out who we are and what we want to identify with. And so for me, I listen to a lot of rock, but I also, at that time, it was all about the Smiths and, you know, the House Martins and these early English bands. And the interesting thing is that I don't listen to that music anymore very often, but when I go and I, you know, put on This Charming Man or something, some song that I haven't heard in 25, 30 years. It's like, I am 14 years old again. Like there is nothing like music that can, it's a time machine. It can, and I feel 14, I feel insecure, I feel nerdy, I'm afraid to talk to people. Like it is incredible how it can do that. And for somebody that creates music, like there are Judge Jackson songs out there that do that for people that'll be like a middle-aged, I don't know, soccer mom taking her kid to practice. And she listens to Judge Jackson. All of a sudden she's 15 years old again. Like do you have music that does that for you? And do you ever think about, holy shit, some of my music does that for people.
I'll be in the car and hearing the Beatles, and all of a sudden I'm like 9 years old again in the back of my parents' car listening to, like, you know, cassette tape going. Like, music is time. That's the thing about music. It's like a bookmark in your life. And when you hear that tune 30 years later, it takes you back to that place and that innocence, and you can't help but just go. That's why we listen to old stuff, because it takes us back, and it's a pure time, and that we associate it with good memories or whatever that association was. And I mean, there can be different associations. There can be sad, like, oh my God, it can provoke all sorts of emotions. That's the power of music, man.
Yeah. And there's something about that music, that about that time in our life, because you mentioned, you know, Chris Stapleton, for example, who I listen to a ton of, and I love it. I'm not going to listen to Chris Stapleton 20 years from now. It's not going to affect me the same way as it, as the music that I grew up listening to when I was a teenager, right? When you look back on your career, Todd, was there ever a point where you thought, holy shit, I made it? Like, I think I made it.
Well, there was one moment in the career that I've had that we were opening up for this band called Buck Cherry.
Oh, yeah.
And we were playing the Phoenix Stadium. And this is when they were having the one big record and things were popping off. And we actually know those guys. We were like, man, we should do some shows together. Well, the first show we ever played was the Phoenix Stadium. They were headlining it, and they brought us in as the direct support. And I remember that place was fucking packed. I mean, I don't know if it was packed, but there might have been like 40,000 people there. It was a good crowd, right? And I remember Pat Tillman? He used to play for the Arizona Cardinals, and sure, he was the guy that ended up getting killed in battle. Well, yeah. I had a buddy that had his jersey, and I put his jersey on for the encore and dedicated a tune called Lift the Bottle for, like, fallen veterans and whatnot. We're still thinking about you. And I remember being on the lip of the stage, looking at his name on the Ring of Fame, wearing his jersey. There must have been 20,000 Marines there at this. It was a military function as well. And I delivered this little spiel that I did. And I just remember standing there talking for like fucking 4 or 5 minutes. And at the end of it, I delivered it perfectly. Like, whatever in my mind perfect was, I was having this moment just on the lip of the stage. And I remember just soaking it in for a minute going, you'll never take this away from me. Like, this, if it ends right now, we're here. We made it. Like, this was to play a stadium. I felt like Bon Jovi feels every day of his life just for a minute. You know what I mean? But it was a pretty powerful gig. We ended up doing 3 shows with them. But that first show, I just remember thinking, man, this is pretty fucking cool. Like, it doesn't matter what happens or what doesn't happen. This moment right here will live in my brain for the rest of my life. But yeah, so there was all sorts of shows that we did that just stood out in a positive way that made me go, yeah, man. Like, when you hear your song on the radio for the first time, I'm driving around in my buddy's Hummer, and they did KLOS, the major station in LA, played like 4 of our tunes one night. They told us they were going to do it. They did a feature on us. That was pretty cool. Hearing your song on the Super Bowl, hearing your song on NASCAR, hearing your song on the radio, on a TV show, in a movie, playing big shows. These little moments all add up to, like, these are great little moments. Dude, getting paid, getting your first royalty check that's of substance, you know, where you're like, I'm making money doing this. Mom always said it's a hobby right up until you make money doing it. Yeah, there's been all sorts of little moments that we had working, like getting calls from like Mick Mars from Motley Crue. I'd like you to write some lyrics for me for my solo record. Yeah, dude, fucking just those kind of little validations that you get along the way where you're like, well, you must be doing something right. Like, here I am hanging out with these cats in this studio in Malibu, in your house, and you're calling me. This is pretty cool. You know, like little moments like that, I don't take for granted, never have, never will, but they all certainly add up to a totality of like, yeah, it's been an interesting little journey.
That's awesome. What are you most excited about now?
Well, watching my daughter grow up, you know, spending time with her, obviously, as any parent would say, like, yeah, I get it. The kids will keep you humble. That's for sure. I'm just excited about everything. I mean, I'm the kind of guy that's pretty just happy to be alive. I probably should be dead. So there's been a few situations that I've been involved in that I've literally walked away from going, yeah, that probably could have killed me. And I think because of those situations, I'm just grateful for every day that I wake up. Every day I wake up, I'm like, man, it's going to be a good day. Even if it's raining, so we're going to get wet. Oh, well, you know, I'm just happy about anything that happens. You know, I've got 3 different projects going on with the music situation right now, which have just naturally started happening. Tunstall's Ranch, which is the Southern Rock thing. The Ruins, which is the band that I was telling you about before they got the deal. And then solo stuff, Todd McTavish. And then, of course, the judge catalog, the, you know, pitching, you know, people are always, can we use this song for this and that? Yeah. So I'm still in it as far as that goes. I still have this dream of just writing songs for other people that happens every once in a while where other people will like cover my tunes, which is the greatest form of flattery. I can't even tell you, like, when people do that, where you're just like, wow, you thought enough of this song to actually cover it. Like, it still blows my mind when people do that, you know, because we're nobodies, you know. There's different scales that you can be at in this industry, the Taylor Swift scale at the top and then anything below it. And we fell somewhere in that medium range. You know, we never had a hit. And you're always looking for that hit song, right? Like, any songwriter will tell you that, like, you ain't shit without that hit. But if that happens, that happens. You can't kind of predict that. You can just write, you know, just write and put it out there and follow it through and, you know, enjoy the process. If that happens, that's so out of your hands. You can't focus on that. You learn, you know, you learn to not even think about it. Actually, it's just like, it's that, that is what it is. I just enjoy writing good quality tunes that when they're recorded and if I listen to and go right on, that's all that matters. That's all that matters in the process. But yeah, I look forward to everything. My day job now is I'm a trucker driving 18, you know, big rigs and whatnot. I fucking love it. My soul, I've realized, likes motion. It's always liked motion. So I'm happy when I'm moving. I can't sit too long before I feel like I need to be moving. So trucking is, I'm always rolling. So I kind of found myself in that and it accommodates my songwriting because I can sit there writing tunes at the same time and just sing my little ass off in my cab and nobody hears it if I'm hitting bad notes. So it's just like, I could just have fun and doing that. But yeah, I look forward to just waking up in the morning, getting after it. You never know what's going to happen. You just got to get out there and give it.
That's amazing, man. Like I do. That's kind of like a badass outlaw sort of country blues way to think about it, right? You know, you're driving around with your long gray goatee in your 18 wheeler, driving across the country, writing songs. Like, that's a pretty badass way to live. Like, if there's a movie one day about your life and all these crazy stories you did, that's going to be an important chapter of that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, like I said before, if that movie, if I was to pick a title out for movies that have existed, I would say There Will Be Blood. Like, I am an outlaw, man. Like, I went to the Wild West. I said, let's go, man. I'm a gunfighter. But no, I think that's a good depiction of it. It's just, I was just one of those guys that just wasn't content playing it safe. I said, man, whatever's going to happen, let's just get out there and enjoy the adventure and meet people. And let's go see some of this country. Let's go see some of this world, you know. And you run into good people everywhere. That's what I've realized. People make a place, you know, and whatever's going on is going on. But you run into the right people, you can have a great time anywhere, man. I mean, that's what I've realized. I've had parties in like back rooms and had the best fucking time because the right people were there. And we walked out going, fuck, that was just a blast. You know, what a great time. So it doesn't matter where you are. It's just enjoy where you're at. Trucker talk.
I don't know if you realize it, Todd, but you've sort of imparted a lot of wisdom in this conversation that I think a lot of people that maybe don't have any relationship with songwriting can take away. Things around, you know, really creating art or content, whatever that means in your life for you, right? And not being swayed by what you think other people want to hear. And most importantly, you got to enjoy the process. I see this with my, you know, with my kids and people around me. Like, God, if you don't enjoy the process and you're working towards some sort of outcome, especially if that's highly dependent on what people think, you're going to run out of energy and time before you ever find whatever success you're looking for.
Focus on the here and the now. Whatever's going to happen down the road, that'll happen. But just focus on the moment. Like, I heard something the other day that it struck a chord where it was like, you know, no matter what you think, you're probably right.
Yeah.
And I always think about that and go, that's so true. Like, if you don't think you can do it, you're probably right. You probably can't. And on the flip side, if you think you can do it, you're probably right. Like, whatever you think, you're probably right. Manifest it. Like, just make it happen. There's people that think about it and don't do anything, but there's other people that think about it and then say, fuck it, let's take this risk. Let's do this. What's the worst that can happen? We can have some good times. We can share some moments. We can have a good memory. Sounds positive to me. And even if it's not, like the Billy Bob Thornton thing, even if it's not, it can be the best thing that could ever happen to you. So you can't go wrong. Like, if it's good, great. If it's not, it still could be good. Don't worry about it. Don't worry what anybody else thinks. That's what I've learned. Doesn't matter what anybody else thinks.
Yeah.
Matters what you think, what you feel like you want to do. Like, that's what matters. And if you can do it legally and make money, even better.
I can't think of a better place to end the conversation there, Todd. This has been so much fun. We're going to include in the show notes links to where they can find the different projects you're working on and the music. I'm going to have to soak on this conversation because you've given me so much to think about. And this is as much fun as I was expecting it to be. This has been awesome. I can't thank you enough for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been totally, totally awesome. And I'm just glad to connect with a few people from my hometown of Kitchener-Waterloo. So this is just a real treat for me.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.